Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 254, recorded for the week of March 27th, 2024. Oracle Autonomous Database is the OG dad joke. Good evening, Ryan and Jonathan. How's it going?
Oh, good. Very good.
I'm surprised we're recording because we were just at odds with each other arguing about which show title was the best this week, because there were some good ones, like, you know, Data Centers of Loudoun County, which you guys will understand here in a couple minutes, and then we had AWS, I'd Like to Make a Return Please, and Legacy Vendor plus Legacy Vendor equals Profit, you know, just a few of the many wonderful show titles that our hosts came up with today, that, you know, we didn't make the grade. We didn't think they were worthy of being the show title, in a very unfair voting process that we use to choose the title once we rate them. But if you were curious about our humor on this, you can definitely check it out in our newsletter, which you can subscribe to on thecloudpod.net, or check it out in our show notes, as we do list all of our failed titles. And our show note writer, Heather, likes to throw in a couple on her own in there too sometimes. So there's even some bonus ones that aren't on the show notes that are only published to the website. So check those out when you, if you're ever curious. Maybe that's when we do, you know, subscribers podcast, you know, maybe we just record the part where we argue about our show titles as part of the, you know, special content you would get if you subscribe to our podcast. Yeah. But yeah, we're not quite ready yet for the paid subscriber model. But, you know, hey, just ideas. We can still come up with things that might work. We are without Matt this week, but Ryan and Jonathan, good to see you.
Hey. Yeah, good to be here. I love the idea of people paying to listen to us, like, squabble.
I mean,
I guess I do it for free, so.
Yeah, I'm saying. I mean, they probably pay more to hang out with us at Amazon reInvent and Google Next, like when we're just, you know, out bitching about everything we just saw for the day. Like, they probably hang out. You know, if we recorded that, they probably pay for that too.
Oh, yeah.
Because those are alcohol infused rants typically of like, what was that? That was crap. And that's how a podcast gets born. So
that's right. Yeah.
All right. Well, I have some follow up for you guys. Last week, we talked about Microsoft hiring the Infleqtion co-founder Mustafa Suleiman and their chief scientist, as well as most of the 70-person team. And we said, what really happens with Infleqtion? And it came out after we recorded the show that Microsoft agreed to pay them $650 million. So, you know, a little way to like, hey, we're going to acqui-hire people without acquiring your company. And Infleqtion had previously raised $1.5 billion. In their funding rounds, which apparently Microsoft was one of the main contributors to some of that as well. So there's not really that many investors after Microsoft. So the $650 million is probably going to go back to pay those guys, as well as anything they can make on selling AI Studio, which I learned is a company that helps others train AI models, which sounds like consulting to me. But that's what it is. It's a the $650 million consists of two parts, $620 million licensing fee, licensing the Infleqtion model, and as well as $30 million to waive any legal rights related to the mass hiring effort, as well as a negotiated $140 million line of credit that Infleqtion can pull from Microsoft as it needs it to fund its operations and pay for the Azure services, which is sort of weird because like Microsoft's paying them to pay them, sort of roundabout. But that explains the mystery that we talked about last week for those who were paying attention.
Makes sense now.
Makes sense now. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of wonder if, you know, this is clearly in the face of regulation around, you know, anti-competitive behavior. So I,
you said it's a very clever way for you to get a bunch of people that you want without getting FTC scrutiny of acquiring the company, and, you know, waiting 9 months.
Yeah, it's kind of like the spirit of the law versus the letter of the law there. So I kind of wonder if actions like this will eventually be like stamped out a little bit. Like, you really can't do this. This is an acquisition by any other name, really.
Yeah, I mean, the FTC is too busy suing Apple and Amazon and Google for other things. So, you know, Microsoft, they already sued them once. You know, they're off the hook for a couple more years. Just turn a blind eye until OpenAI is taking over the world, and then they'll have antitrust for OpenAI and Microsoft.
Do you think this would offend like antitrust? Because it just seems like there's so much in the market right now that seems unlikely.
I mean, it wouldn't. I mean, I'm not a monopoly Sherman Trust Act lawyer, but I don't pretend to play one either. But I would assume at this point it is not. But it is interesting because Microsoft is basically using their very large amount of money to basically take a competitor out of the space, out of, you know, who competes with OpenAI, which they also happen to be a very large investor in. and have a partnership where they sell and resell it. So I imagine you could argue some collusion-y type things, but what those exactly are, I'm not a lawyer. Well, if you want to get mad at lawyers, Redis has you this week, where they have announced that they are switching away from its open source three-clause BSD license. Instead, it's adopting a dual licensing model called the Redis Source Available License V2 and the server-side public licensing. And for those of you who listened to us for a while, you know the SSPL is the anti-cloud licensing model. Under the new license, cloud service providers hosting Redis will need to enter into a commercial agreement with Redis, and the first company to do so was Microsoft. Redis also announced the acquisition of Speedy to take it beyond the in-memory space. This isn't the first time Redis has changed the licensing model, going back to 2018 and 2019 when it changed the way it licensed Redis modules under the Redis Source Available License V1. And Redis CEO Rowan Trollope said they switched from the same reasons. He thinks that everyone has to switch to the SSLP, particularly when they are making an acquisition like SpeedyB. It's a big investment. If they include in Redis and cloud service providers just pick it up and ship it without paying anything, that's problematic for Redis's ability to profit off of their acquisition. Redis Trollope, who joined the company a year ago, said customers he spoke to about the change were not concerned, even though as per definition of the Open Source Institute, it isn't technically open source anymore. He also said he would not be surprised if Amazon sponsored a fork for Redis. With the change of Redis is also considering consolidating Redis Stack and Redis Community Edition to a single distribution. And they talk about their Speedy acquisition, which is a RocksDB compatible key value storage engine, which may seem odd for Redis to acquire, but Redis began as an all in memory play and that made sense when they built it. But now with NVMe drives and their higher transfer rates, being able to leverage the middle ground of your fast cache on disk and your in-memory database is an interesting play. Allows you to scale to larger and larger values of in-memory data. Basically, Redis is planning to IPO at some point, and they still plan to, but once the market window reopens. And if you'd like to know, there are already three forks as of recording for Redis. First, there was already KeyDB, which Snap Inc. bought in May 2022. KeyDB is a high-performance fork of Redis with a focus on multi-threading, memory efficiency, and high throughput. There's a copy left fork for Redis announced by Drew DeVault, which he blogged about on March 22nd after the announcement of the SSPL. Drew is known as a bit of a dick in the open source community, but he is also an uncompromising advocate for free and open source software. And I quoted that from someone else. I did not call him that. Yeah. But it was the comment in the article that I read. Madeline Olson and some other former Redis contributors have also created a fork with the current name Placeholder KV. Madeline happens to be employed by AWS at this time, but says this is not sponsored by them, which was followed up by a Twitter retweet by Werner Vogels himself saying he's really proud of the community and them building an open source alternative. But he did reiterate this is not sponsored by Amazon at this time. Now, Amazon has not announced what they're going to do yet, but I wouldn't be shocked to find out they're going to help put some weight behind Placeholder KV versus one of the other two or creating another fork on top of these three existing ones. As we mentioned earlier, Microsoft is the first cloud provider to license new Redis. And of course, they wrote a blog post about it because why not? And through the partnership, they will continue to offer integrated solutions like Azure Cache or Redis, ensuring that they have access to latest features and capabilities. And they say there will be no interruption to Azure Cache or Redis, Redis Enterprise, and Enterprise Flash services, and customers will receive timely updates to their Redis going forward.
You know, I'm less bothered by Redis doing this than I think I have been about anybody else. Maybe I'm just kind of getting numb to it now a little bit.
Beating you down. Yeah.
Maybe. I'm not sure what it is. I mean, I feel like there's a key difference between something that works at runtime in an application or something that a cloud vendor would adopt and then sell as their own service and something like Terraform. I think there's some significant differences there. So I think the types of people who are using Redis at scale in production apps will want to pay for support. They'll want to support, they'll want contracts for, 24/7 support and patches, security patching and all that kind of stuff. So like, I think the people are already paying anyway, and so they're not going to be affected. And then there's the people who are using it in home projects or sort of non-production projects. They're really not going to be affected by this. It really is just a stab at the hyperscalers who are taking somebody else's IP and monetizing it. So I'm more okay with this than I have been with anything else.
I mean, I still think that the hypervisors are going to pass on the cost of these licensed agreements into their services. And so it is for everyone who wants to deploy just a managed Redis cluster and not have to think about it and just wants to leverage it for the app. I imagine that this is going to make those costs of those managed services go up. It's the only thing I really don't like about it. I also kind of understand from the open source provider that, you know, like, how do you make it make sense? So,
I mean, there's an easy solution to this, I think, which is that, you know, the Amazons of the world.
Get rid of all money and come.
Well.
Wow, that's one viewpoint.
In the future, we don't need money. Is that right, Ryan?
Yeah.
You didn't buy into that sci-fi thing. Yeah, so I think the hyperscalers can stop selling Redis or Elasticsearch or whatever as a managed service in itself. And what they can sell instead is the management system, which manages the open source version of the thing. So you come along with your free Redis, and they come along with the automation, you know, the Lambda functions, the glue that actually does deployments for you and manages data and life cycling and backups and everything else. They're selling you that as a service, not Redis itself. And I think that's going to be an easy way out for them to continue to actually get, you know, drive value for customers while not really having to pay for this licensing at all. That's what I'd do.
Well, I know, like, I'm not sure, I haven't read the details of this one, but I know with Elasticsearch, the first thing they did was, you know, basically make the open source version very non-compatible with the licensed version, right?
When they switched over this model.
And so yeah. I think it works in the short term where, you know, the managed service is really the value there. But then over time, feature development and that, they sort of diverge and it makes it difficult for users. But I would like to see management be an overhead and then bring your own license sort of, you know, type agreements and that sort of thing to sort of.
I mean, do you think the reason why you don't hate this as much is because unlike, you know, Terraform and Mongo and these guys, you know, Redis is relatively stable. I mean, for the core functionality of what Redis does, like, doesn't change much. And so if you don't care about any of the new features, you can run on the current open source version of Redis probably forever and be perfectly happy. Versus, you know, Mongo still rapidly changing. You got a lot of things happening. Elasticsearch, a lot of things are changing underneath it. Terraform, you know, there was a pretty active third-party community who had built Terraform Enterprise competitors around that, you know, got hurt. And, you know, I'm not aware of anybody who's making a commercially viable version of Redis other than the hyperscalers. And again, because it's so mature of a product, I just don't know that I'm as threatened by this as I was about Terraform.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah, Terraform is a different beast altogether, I think, in this model. Like, I don't even, it is the same thing, but in my head, it's like its own thing. And then there's the Elasticsearch and Redis and Mongo, which is a little bit more of an application component. You know, it's a technology that I can choose to leverage within my app versus Terraform. I guess technically, but it's so, like, you know, when working in Google, like, it's, you don't really have a great option, you know, like, other than querying the APIs directly, because the client libraries aren't good enough. The community around coding of that is really an option. And so it's sort of tricky to not use Terraform. And some, you know, and I hear similar things about trying to use, you know, infrastructure provisioning and managed service provisioning configuration in Azure as well. So I don't know.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. We'll see if Amazon responds here shortly with what they're going to do to support ElastiCache. But again, I would put my money on this solution from Madeline over that one. It sounds like, you know, the big issue between Drew's solution and Madeline's is the copy left part of it. And, you know, Amazon's not super thrilled with the copy left idea. And so that's probably the big difference between the two. Otherwise, they're relatively the same, and they should just combine efforts. And I actually think the name that Drew picked, which is Redict, is not bad. So versus Placeholder PV, which they do have a pull request, an issue on GitHub. You can go give suggestions for what they should name it if you don't like Placeholder KV. But I kind of like it to be Placeholder KV forever, because that's just sort of funny.
I thought it was hilarious. Yeah.
So. All right, well, let's move on to AI is going great. So I think we briefly talked about Sora a little while ago when it first came out. So for those of you who have not been paying attention to this, Sora is basically a capability from ChatGPT, which allows you to take text and turn it into video, which, of course, would be a big threat to everyone in Hollywood. And, you know, we didn't really talk about it much here other than maybe a side mention, because it was not very impressive in the first version. And so, you know, it's interesting because OpenAI had a blog post that I thought we'd highlight real quickly here, where they basically got a bunch of creators who created really compelling and interesting things with it. And so they're sharing those with the community, and it's kind of worth seeing what they can do. You know, it also wasn't available to most people. You had to be kind of in a private, secret, swirl group to access it. You know, but there was really bad ones, like you know, someone trying to create a person and the person had like 12 arms and, you know, weird things like that. So anyway, OpenAI has blog posts created by production companies and directors. So you can see what's possible to do. And, you know, they're pretty decent. Paul Trillo, one of the people who has a video here, he's a director, says, Sora at its most powerful when you are not replicating the old, but bringing to life new and impossible ideas we would have otherwise never had the opportunity to see. And when you look at the videos, you can kind of definitely see the more abstract nature of them. One of the ones I kind of like was one called Shy Kids by the Shy Kids Studio. It's called Airhead, which is like a person with a balloon head. He kind of goes through different things. And then Paul Trillo's video is a pretty abstract art concept, but you know, married with some real life areas and really interesting. But there's like 7 or 8 videos here, all very interesting and worth checking out if you are curious about what AI can do for video and why maybe the writers and the actors all struck, you know, had strikes about it, because it could be pretty compelling long term.
Yeah, I like the golden records worth checking out as well. It's very, I kind of wonder if it was like a reference to like the golden record that's put on Pioneer or something and sent out into space. It was very much kind of space themed, and it's really quite amazing. But, you know, but it's not people. It's not people acting. It's not a movie. It's nowhere close to generating full movies yet. But I'm really glad that they actually gave the technology to people who were actually, you know, content creators who had good ideas, who could be very descriptive in what they wanted the tool to build. Because I think the problem the first time around was, you know, we've got a great tool and this is kind of how it works, but you know, they're not skilled at using it yet. But I think giving it to people who already had the skills to describe in great detail what they wanted out of it has been really fruitful. But yeah, super excited to see what that's going to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to think of, you know, like people like to focus on how disruptive this is going to be, but I'm not sure it's going to be as disruptive as it's going to be an enablement. You know, like if you're making a movie or a show or something, you're already having to communicate your vision to everyone working on the thing. And so like, it's, you know, whether you're doing storyboarding or trying to get, you know, working with wardrobe or, you know, lighting, all these kinds of things. And so I think those are the people that can communicate that vision are going to be able to really take advantage of this.
It's disruptive. Like LLM is going to be disruptive for coding. Like if you already know exactly what you want and you can very eloquently describe it to a system, then it can go write the code for you. Then it will go do the thing. So it's the same as Sora. I think you would need to have immense skill to use a tool like this to make it be competitive against traditional technology. So you know, maybe TikTok will do something like this. Maybe you can have Sora auto generate a music video to go with some lyrics. I don't know exactly, but it's far off from you know, rendering a 90-minute long feature-length movie and putting actors out of business. I can see it very easily putting a lot of visual effects people out of business very quickly.
I mean, everything I hear about visual effects people is that they work ridiculously crazy hours to make, you know, like to do weird things, like put a dress on somebody because the director decided the dress the actor was wearing at the time didn't make any sense to the scene. And like, you know, so I don't know that those people would be that upset if they could really focus on just, CGI that mattered versus dumb CGI. But it definitely could be disruptive to some of those areas. But again, some of those areas are just sweatshops of people doing silly, trivial things.
Yeah, it's like airbrushing out the wires that hung the stuntman from the from the rig or something, frame by frame by frame.
Yeah, I've heard of airbrushing out the mustache. They didn't like it. You know, like crazy stuff like that.
Really?
All right, let's move on to AWS. And they gave us a little bit of a gift this week, guys. Not a lot of fanfare and a very, very short announcement video, a blog post. They announced that customers can now return savings plans within 7 days of purchase. Savings plans are a flexible pricing model that can help you reduce your bill by up to 72% compared to on-demand prices in exchange for a 1 or 3 year hourly spend commitment, either no upfront or fully upfront or partially upfront. Now, if you accidentally screwed up and you can return it and you needed to repurchase another plan that better matches your direct need, I assume this would, of course, require a support case, but it does not. It's built right into the console. And as simple as going to the savings plan menu and cost management console inventory, and then selecting the plan and choosing return savings plan. There are some restrictions, like you can't do it all the time. So there's a quota around this, and the savings plan must be in an active state, can't be impending. There's also a couple other things about, like, if it's over $100 an hour, they'd like you to contact them, because that's a pretty big mistake. But, you know, otherwise, this is a pretty nice thing. And, you know, having been the guy who had to push that button many times on very large commitments, I appreciate the ability to undo without having to beg my sales rep.
Yeah, no, that was my first thought, too. It's like, I've had to do this, and it was, like, puckering. It was scary. And so, like, I'm glad to get a little relief for those users who are like, I think I know what I'm doing. Someone from finance says I have to go do this thing I've never done before. Go ahead.
I'd like to think you can return at any time, obviously with the penalty. But I can see cases, especially in tough economic times, where you paid for a three-year plan, and you know it's cancel it or go out of business. You know what's it going to be? So you know, I'd like to see options in the future to pay it off early with a penalty.
I mean, nice. You know, at one point you could resell these things on marketplaces and things like that, and then people were abusing it, and so Amazon took it away. But it would be nice to still have some of those capabilities and options, saying, "Hey, you know," because at the end of the day, it's a commitment to Amazon. It doesn't really mean much if you don't deliver it, unless they're, you know, I don't think they're taking that as a deferred revenue number in their revenue, you know, that they report to the street or anything crazy like that. So yeah, it's sort of a little bit arbitrary, which is why you always could, you know, if you did mess up, you could typically work with your salesperson and they would help you unscrew up. But, you know, it took some begging and pleading, and like they made you nervous while you waited like a week or two for someone to come back and say, yes, you can, or, you know. So it was, you know, to have it just kind of built in is super handy. But there are definitely things they can do if you are in trouble. And yeah, I think if the difference is, you know, turn off the savings plan or we're out of business and we don't pay you anything, I bet Amazon could probably figure it out. So, all right. You can now improve the security of your software supply chain with Amazon Code Artifact package group configuration. For administrators of package repositories, you can manage the configuration of multiple packages in one single place with the new AWS Code Artifact package group configuration capabilities. A package group allows you to define how packages are updated by internal developers or from upstream repositories. You can now allow or block internal developers to publish packages or allow or block upstream updates for a group of packages. Simple applications routinely include dozens of packages, and to minimize the risk of supply chain attacks, some organizations manually vet the packages that are available in internal repositories and the developers who are authorized to update those packages. And there are three ways to update the package in a repository. Administrators previously had to manage the important security settings of the packages with allow and block and internal publish controls, but now they can define these three security parameters for a group of packages at one time, and the packages are identified by their type, their namespace, and their name. Scalability operates at the domain level, not the repository level.
This is definitely handy for those internal teams who have had to manage this, just because it's, you know, it's not the end of the world, but it's toil having to, you know, iterate through and go through each layer and set packet, you know, set the security settings. So this is helpful.
I mean, like the idea of having to manually vet packages to me is just like my definition of hell. Like, oh, look, I got to go update from, you know, the upstream Red Hat repository and go approve these things. And yeah, like there, you know, there's a major release and there's like 300 packages with it, and you have to go through each one of them and manually approve it. Oh, kill me now. Yeah. You know, I just feel bad for all those people who had to manually review them. But yeah, thanks. And I can now select all and say approved, which is, I guess, helpful.
Yep.
Yeah, I think it's more important for things like PyPy repos and NPM, where it's very much community driven. And there aren't the guardrails in place. I mean, I think slipping something into a Linux kernel is probably significantly harder because of the approval steps and the reviews that happen. But for somebody to incorporate something malicious into a PyPy package is very easy, and it happens all the time. In fact, I think I just read something this morning or yesterday about, you know, another 700,000 people who've installed this compromised package from PyPy. So it's good as long as, you know, when you freeze it, it's a known good version.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
how much work do you think that reviewer is actually doing on the code? Because you know you're not paying a highly competent Python developer to manually approve these. You're paying an intern or some lowly SOC engineer who has to go and review these things. Like, how much scrutiny do you think they're actually putting on them? That's the question.
Not enough. And I think the entire thing needs to be automated. You know, we need AI to look at, inspect these packages before they get added to the, you know, the frozen package list that says, is it doing anything different than it was doing before? Is it doing DNS queries? Is it contacting a host it never used to contact? Like, what, especially IO based things, like, what's it doing that it wasn't doing last time? And is that a risk?
I mean, they sell these things as compromise, but I think it's really about, you know, the company risk and making sure that it has the right licensed version that you can use. Using your code, you're not liable.
Yes, it's GPL3, not SSPL, and we're a cloud provider. Yeah, those kind of things. I would like to see, maybe this is kind of the beginning of an idea for they have around, you know, being able to tie this into Inspector, being able to tie this into maybe other third-party databases of known good packages or bad packages. Because, you know, SNCC has this data. There's a bunch of other third-party tools that are out there, Black Duck, et cetera, that have good data on third-party repositories. And it'd be nice if you just plug them into this and then, you know, it can give you a recommendation set and say, yes, I accept your recommendations because I trust you. I don't trust, you know, that pesky upstream people. So maybe this is the beginning of something that's a little bit easier for all of that, which would be good to see. So we'll see. AWS Batch, which is Amazon's fully managed service that helps you run batch workloads across a range of AWS compute offerings in a million different ways.
Has fully, some new features. Fully managed.
Yeah.
Fully managed. Yeah.
That's definitely in quotes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Traditionally, if you're using AWS Batch, you only are allowed to use a single container job and required extra steps to merge all your components into a monolithic container. It also did not allow using separate sidecar containers, which are auxiliary containers that are complement the main application by providing additional services like data logging. But now they offer you multi-container jobs, making it easier and faster to run large-scale simulations in areas like autonomous vehicles and robotics. And these workloads are usually divided between the simulation itself and the system under test, known as the agent, that interacts with the simulation. These two components are often developed and optimized by different teams. And with this capability, you get multiple containers per job. You get advanced scaling, scheduling, and cost optimization provided by AWS Batch. And you can use modular containers representing different components like 3D environments, robot sensors, or monitoring sidecars. Which is sort of a weird way to write this article, that they, you know, their example of how to use it was this weird vehicle robotic thing. But net-net, you get multiple container jobs and you can do things you couldn't do before.
So Kubernetes pods for batch.
Yeah.
So why do we need batch?
You know, why do you need serverless? I
mean, I've always thought batch was a tool that was waiting for a problem to solve. But, you know.
I feel like what they give to all the mainframe guys, like, hey, you want batch processing? You don't want to spend, you know, bajillions of dollars with IBM for batching? Here, we have a batching capability. That's what I always kind of felt like this was for, was for those people. Because, yeah, there's thousands of other ways to do this.
Yeah. I mean, as a tool who used batch once.
you call yourself a tool or I did. A fool?
Yeah, it was a tool. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it does a job. I wouldn't say it's fully managed. You pretty much have to bring a lot of your own management into it, but the simplicity of it for doing what it does do is really good. And to add the complexity of sidecars and all this other stuff, like, I just don't think it's the right choice to add these features into batch. I think you'd be better served just building some automation around an EKS cluster to solve the same problems. It's a weird mix of.
To be fair, when we used it, I don't think Fargate for ECS was out either. So it was like you really had to bring your own cluster and that.
Yeah, you had to bring everything to it.
But, so it's a little bit more managed, but I imagine you still have to define all of those things that you would define in an ECS cluster or an EKS cluster.
Yeah, but I think the type of customers who use it are the types of customers who have specific requirements around the hardware that this is going to run on. Apart from us, who use it for laziness purposes, but
is that what it's for? Maybe that's the thing. Maybe I just don't understand what this tool is yet. Because I really don't know what workload I would throw on this. I don't get it. I never have. Even when we used it, it was sort of hopeful, like, oh, you know, let's try this and maybe it'll all make sense. And then we used it and it's like, this makes less sense now.
It's sort of like that time we were at reInvent and we talked to the you know, he was product manager for a couple of things, but one of those was Beanstalk, and we were all like, so who really uses this thing? And he's like, it's one of the number one used services on Amazon. We're like, it is? I bet if we were to ask him about, you know, whoever the product manager is for batches, I bet you'd be surprised what it can do and how many people use it and what their use cases
probably
are. But you know, again, I think it's for legacy support more than anything, because when you get into like heavy duty mainframe, big DB2 instances, you know, batching is a big thing, and then you get into, you know, I can see batch being applicable to potentially do data loading into ML use cases. But then I think that's built into SageMaker already, so I don't know that
you need batch. There's like six other ways that, please don't add another one. But yeah.
All right, moving on to GCP, which is, you know, starting to get dumpy here a little bit, you know, dropping stuff that could have been a good topic for main stage at Next, but wasn't AI. So it's here instead. that's how I see it. So first up, Google Cloud VMware Engine supercharged with Google Cloud NetApp Volumes. You can now use Google Cloud VMware Engine with the NetApp Volumes. The combination reduces operational overhead and lowers the cost of migrating and managing VMware applications. And your legacy data center team, who you've told to manage the Google Cloud, are now ecstatic because they can now use all the same things they use on-premise as well. Leverage Google's Cloud's Planet Scale. And NetApp Volumes are fully certified and supported as NFS data source for Google Cloud VMware Engine, so it is not iSCSI, but NFS solves most of your needs.
Do not use NFS as a data store for VMware.
I mean, I've done it multiple times. It was fine. And so you put databases on it. Don't do databases, but web servers on it. It was fine.
Yeah.
It's not quite as performant as much as they say. It's not quite as performant as a SAN.
Well, the problem with NFS in this model is the multicast nature of NFS and the amount of network traffic that it puts out there that you don't really, you know, that's the bigger problem with running NFS for VMware at scale is you run into a lot of network chatter.
However, running it in this mechanism, that's Google's problem. So
yeah, not my problem.
I don't think I care.
Yeah. Good luck to you, Google.
Yeah.
Google is updating the default org policies under their secure by default organization resources. I mean, it only been nice if you could come up with that before you launched a cloud, but whatever. Mm-hmm. Potentially insecure postures and outcomes are addressed with bundles of policies that are enforced as soon as a new organization resource is created. Existing orgs will not be impacted by the change. Some of the new, stronger defaults of the org policies are, for IAM, disable service account creation, disable automatic IAM grants for default service accounts, and disable service account key uploads. For storage, they will turn off public cloud storage buckets from using per object ACLs to provide access, enforcing consistency for access management and auditing, and they will enforce a central contacts constraint, which is a new default policy to constrain for central contacts limiting contacts to only the managed user identities. Which, if you understand how Google Workspaces works, the central contacts makes a lot of sense. If you don't really understand how Google Workspaces work, you have no idea why you need a central contacts. But let me tell you, you definitely do.
Yes. Yes, you do. Yeah. I mean, these are sane and they should have been around forever. I mean, the default automatic IAM grants for default service accounts is horrendous. Subscribing to an API shouldn't mean that you create a principal identity that has full admin access to that service. Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me why you would do that. And so these are good. Good same things to have. And if you have an existing org, I recommend going through and checking that you have some of these on. You know, it's uniform bucket level access. Everyone gets burned by that. That's more of an operations just sanity check, right? Like, it's less about security and protection as it is like, I lost the ability to delete my object. And now you can. I like it.
I mean, I think that's about DLP more than anything, isn't it? It's like you've got a bucket, but you don't want somebody to put something in the bucket and set a different policy on it that allows exfiltration of that data more easily.
Yeah, I mean, it's a security thing because like they want you want to explicitly set the ACL. You don't want it to just be a default thing where people can do it. That's how you end up with things being publicly available that you thought were protected in a non-public bucket. It's, you know, learning from the sins of Amazon on this one a little bit.
Well, and this is also like the you know, when doing cross account across S3, you know, the owner owns up, I forget what it's called now, but that ACL where the owner of the bucket can maintain the object is more akin to that. So it's different things locking, you know, it's your bucket, but you can't manage any of the objects in it. You can't delete them. You can't do anything there. And so this will prevent that where everything in the bucket has the same consistent ACLs across all the objects. Just makes it easier.
Yeah. I kind of feel like S3 had that a long time ago. You said the bucket policy. And the bucket policy you could disable per device ACL or per object ACLs.
Mm-hmm. Oh no, it's been around forever. But you know, how did you learn that one? Probably by not being able to delete objects. Same way I did.
Yes, that's exactly how I learned. And then I said, son of a biscuit, and I bitched about it and then I had an epiphany. I'm like, oh, that's more secure. do that properly. Security gets in the way of ease sometimes, but for good reasons.
And this is just, you know, like you still have the option to set per object ACLs, and this is just, you're still setting an ACL. It's just consistent at the bucket level versus the object level.
Creating public buckets now for like static websites, it's still so much fun now with all the warnings they give you, like, you're doing a really, really bad thing. I'm like, yes, I know I am, because I'm doing a static website that I don't care about. But yeah, back in the day, you just hit a button, it was public, and you know, all our secrets were exposed. Now it's like 17 confirmations. Do you really know what you're doing? Are you sure? Have you turned off the thing at the account level first? Yeah, I'll get some. Guess what? Google now speaks sonnets and haikus as well, as they're now generally available in Vertex AI. We talked about both of these at length in the past, but we won't talk about it again. And we'll come back to you when Opus is released, which Google is promising is only a few weeks away. So Amazon or Google, who's going to get it first? We'll see.
Google get it first.
Why do you say that?
They got more money.
Okay, fair enough.
No, it's actually really well priced, though. Comparing the price of Gemini and Palm, and there's an awesome doc which I should actually link to into the notes. But price per token is actually really, really, really reasonable to use any of these models. And if there's no upfront cost and no like hourly cost, and you can just query these things on demand, like the bigger model called 3 Sonnet was $3 per million tokens. And if assume that a token is somewhere between, you know, 1 and 3 characters of English text, average about 2, that's an awful lot of text for $3. That's for the input context, and for the output context, it's more expensive because that's the bit that does the work, and that's $15 per million tokens out. But it's not like, it's something we can work with. Like, it's not going to break the bank.
I don't know, it's my new fun game to just ask people to explain tokens to me now. What's a token? And how do I measure it? And then they sigh, like,
yeah.
And then they go, well, it's, you know, because it's not an easy metric to, especially the FinOps people, you know, are particularly enjoying it right now because they had to figure this out as their companies are all rushing to AI. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a complex answer to that question. And it depends on the model in a lot of ways, which it makes it even worse because it's not consistent as an industry standard.
Yeah, yeah. Most of the tokenizers I've seen are very similar in the way they work. And so the difference is mostly going to be around the size of the model that you're trying to build to begin with. You know, if you're building a massive model like GPT-4, yes, you're going to need more tokens because you're potentially not just looking at English, looking at 70 other languages, and then some very specific tokens for the things around programming, like curly braces or constructs that programmers use. Then you'll use tokens for things like, you know, this was the end of a sentence, or this is when you should stop talking and let somebody else take over. So there's lots of sort of tokens that aren't necessarily directly related to the text that you type into it. But the tokenizers and detokenizers are publicly available. The training sets are not, but you can actually see the mapping of how a token maps back to an input or an output set of characters. So FinOps people can be kept happy if they want to put some effort in. But yeah, I think like one token per 2-ish characters of text input is probably a good estimate.
Fair enough. Well, neighbors of cloud data centers have been raising the alarm of these power-hungry, mega AC-powered humming boxes for the last year or so. We've talked about it here a few times. And Google has, of course, several in Loudoun County, Virginia. And Google and Deloitte have released a report to evaluate the progress to drive positive economic, social, and environmental impacts. And or, hey, neighbors, here's why you should shut up and complaining about it, because this is what we're giving you. 5 highlights from Google in the report is an economic engine for Loudoun County, adding $1.1 billion annually to the county's GDP. And Google's operations created 3,600 jobs, including 400 direct jobs in 2022. So 3,600 jobs to build it, 400 to keep running it, let's be clear. As well as the tax revenue has helped support the county schools, social services, and more. Social advancement through community support with $2.4 million in grants and STEM educational programs they've paid for. They're training tomorrow's workforce to move hard drives in and out of racks, with Google partnering with 16 educational institutions to provide certifications that can be completed within 3 to 6 months. They're powering a cleaner future by delivering 3 times the computing power using the same amount of power they did 5 years ago. And they also announced a 10-year program to buy power with AES to supply 24/7 carbon-free energy. as well as their climate conscious water stewards, where they get a little vague about it, what that means. But they say they have a climate conscious approach to data center cooling. The report was clearly paid for by Google, so nothing critical is mentioned in it. And I like to see a third party analysis of what actual impact of these things is in the market. But expect to see a lot more of this as I think there's some politicians now starting to run against these data centers in those states as citizens are mad. I'd be mad too if there was a data center in my backyard humming all the time.
Well, that's what I wonder. Is it a complaint like noise, or is the complaint like there's not enough energy for like other small business or that? Like, I was kind of curious.
It's mostly noise. It's the most complaints are the biggest because they have generators. They have lots of AC cooling towers that are constantly running. Energy is a concern for some people, but that's not the primary concern. It's the fact that there's a constant noise all the time in a beautiful part of the country that used to be just fields and green and now is boxes that are ugly and humming. Google Cloud Run is Google's fully managed container platform running directly on top of Google's scalable infrastructure to simplify developers' lives and make it easier to build cloud-native apps. And Cloud Run instance had access to its own local file system, but until now, you couldn't access shared data stored in a local file system, forcing developers to use those pesky complex hacks or look at other services to meet their needs. But Google is now announcing in preview volume mounts. With volume mounts, mounting a volume in Cloud Run service or job is a single command. You can either mount a cloud storage bucket or an NFS share, like a cloud file store instance. This allows your containers to access the storage bucket or file server content as if the files were local, utilizing file system semantics for familiar experiences. There are some limitations, though, you should be aware of. First of all, Cloud Run for using cloud storage, which are buckets, uses Fuse. Fuse is not POSIX compliant, nor does it have any concurrency control for multiple writes to the same file. So, yes, you can do this, but now you have to figure out how to coordinate file locking, so good luck to you on that. And for writing to an NFS volume, your container must run as root, which is a security problem, and Cloud Run does not support NFS locking, and NFS volumes are automatically mounted in no-lock mode. So if you would like to create Cloud Run jobs that now have to manage their own consistency, knock yourself out.
Yeah.
Great for read access.
Not so much for write.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the, we need to mount training data, but not write it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, not having to copy that around, which is, you know, which is a good thing, but it is, you know, like it is one of those things. I wish they would blunt the rough edges on this a little bit, just because everyone burns themselves with Fuse drivers in the same way. And it's so ugly because it's painful in a way that equals data loss and in some cases unrecoverable. Sort of errors, especially it works fine at smaller scales and then until it doesn't, you know, and I hate problems like that when you have to troubleshoot them out.
Yeah. It worked fine for 6 months until we got traffic on it and then it blew up in spectacular fashion. Yeah. It's a terrible scenario. So yes, this is available to you. Use with care if you're trying to do anything real other than reading data. So.
And no, you can't make me put Microsoft SQL Server into Cloud Run.
No, I wouldn't do that to you.
I think if anyone wants to use this, they should first look at the history of S3FS and the disasters that have happened around there and why Amazon moved away from Fuse for their integration.
But they've gone back to Fuse, haven't they?
Well, it's Fuse-like, but it's read-only, really.
It's read-only.
It's very limited, and I think that I kind of wish I saw that in this offering as well, where it's like that's an example. They took the original Fuse driver system for writing S3, and the replacement of it is specific to, you know, training data and that sort of that type of use case where a user isn't going to accidentally, through, you know, using tools that they're normally using, going to introduce a whole bunch of data loss and errors.
I mean, one step towards the dream of real stateful data, but not this one. This was not for you. That's what you want.
There's other drivers too, which is, you know, when you think about the Kubernetes and like all the CSI stuff and like, it's interesting to me that they're doing it this way, and it makes me wonder what the infrastructure underneath Cloud Run is, because I don't think it's the same as their GKE.
Bubblegum and duct tape?
Yeah, probably.
it's AWS Batch.
That's it. That explains a lot.
Okay. Yeah. Aha.
Well, for the Cloud Run team, apparently, or for others running GKE at scale, there's new quota monitoring for you. Managing the growth of your Kubernetes cluster with GKE just got easier with the recently introduced ability to directly monitor and set alerts for crucial scalability limits, providing you with deeper insight and control over your Kubernetes environment. The specific limits you can now keep track of include etc database size in gigabytes, which is important because if you run out of disk space for your etcd cluster state, you have a bad day.
Not good.
Nodes per cluster, get proactive alerts on your cluster's overall node capacity. Nodes per node pool in all zones for manage node distribution and limits across specific node pools. Pods per cluster for both GKE standard and GKE autopilot, ensuring you have the pod capacity to support your apps. And containers per cluster for both standard and autopilot to prevent issues by understanding the maximum number of containers your cluster can support at any time.
Yeah, these features are super, super cool for anyone who's running sort of Kubernetes as a platform service for the rest of their business. Previously, before this, right, you'd hit all these same limitations, except for it's hard and you can't do anything about it, right? At least with quotas, you can sort of manage it and you can set them where you can relax them and sort of reevaluate. I know, you know, I've hit the Etsy database size with, you know, rapidly scaling clusters really fast, right? And it's when that fails, it is spectacular. It's amazing how little will work once you hit that limit. But then, you know, the typical node per cluster and pods per cluster is just, it's just helpful and can be, you know, very useful for a team who's, maybe there's multiple teams using a cluster, sharing that space, understanding the use cases on it from a general platform level versus at the per pod or per namespace level. Yeah.
I mean, it'd be nice if autopilot just took care of this, because that's another point of autopilot. I don't have to worry about this.
Yeah, until it runs out of memory in the etcd database and the whole thing goes down. So it's like, it's still being managed somewhere.
Exactly. All right, let's move on to Azure, who had a study as well. I love these studies and they get paid for by vendors. This time they paid GigaOm to vet the Microsoft DevBox and how it impacts developer productivity. Traditionally, physical workstations are frequently hampered by complex environmental setup, loss of productivity from conflicting configurations, and a lack of scalability. And so they created the DevBox to help developers get started more quickly and also be able to task switch between things. So if you're working on one monolithic code base or one microservice on this dev environment, and you're doing a build that's going to take 2 or 3 hours because you wrote bad code, you can now switch over to another DevBox and work on something else while you wait for the other thing to do. So it allows you to do some cool things. But anyways... the quote, or the first thing here, is there has been a little advancement in the administration, automation, or defining of highly customized VDI solutions until now. Microsoft DevBox delivers significant benefit over outfitting developer teams with traditional laptops or VDI server stations. GigaOm's hand-on testing further broke down this takeaway into three primary findings. The Microsoft DevBox significantly improved developer productivity and reduced configuration time and IT overhead compared to VDI. Developer typing experience felt as good as on a local machine, even over hotspot and public Wi-Fi. And a Visual Studio equipped Microsoft DevBox setup produced better performance with sample Chromium codebase than VDI or local clients. They say it transforms the dev experience and accelerates dev workflows with project-based configurations, which is that quick switching I mentioned to you. And then you can also maintain centralized security and management. So thanks, GigaOm, who got paid by Microsoft, telling us that Microsoft solution is great. I always appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm highly skeptical of these things where they're like, it simplifies the configuration and all these things, but centralizing it, I'm like... We haven't been able to do that effectively on local workstations, much less VDIs, and I don't really see the dev box as being any different of a pattern, unless you're going to be overly restrictive on what you're giving your developers and handcuffing them in new ways. Yeah. So, yeah,
you know, I'm sort of intrigued by it, because we switched over to Windows 365 for some VDI workloads, which is, you know, more of a traditional VDI solution, but you know what I think our developers really would like is this kind of idea of a dev box. And so we should play with that. I'm intrigued enough to at least kick the tires on it, see if it's a false prophet or not.
Mm-hmm. I guess the beauty of it is, you know, if you break it, you make a new one. You don't have to basically 2 days to rebuild the Mac.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing of having like an ephemeral dev environment by a branch of code. Like, well, I have an ephemeral dev environment that I do my local dev in, and then I can destroy it or rebuild it whenever I need it. I mean, like, the dream is beautiful. Like, you know, that was the dream of what VDI be able to provide and never worked. So I don't blame Ryan for being skeptical, but I'm also intrigued by it a little bit, enough that I would probably sponsor a POC.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's all about productivity, though, and not about the real reasons that people are moving to these VDIs for dev work. And that's really about supply chain.
No one cares about security, Jonathan. And dev pipelines and dev workflow and SDLC.
Well, but I mean, that's... VDI solutions are always pushed on you in the guise of security, right? It's this way to control
We want to protect our source code at all costs.
The environment, yeah. And to isolate these down, which is all fine until it's overly restrictive and you can't do anything with that VDI environment. I think it's a pretty good example of the, you know, rolling out the VDI in my experience versus your experience. And it was just like, this is an unusable thing. And you're like, this is fantastic. I'm like, yeah, there's no rules on yours. This would be a great solution if it was actually like managed the way it should be managed. But because these are always in the guise of security, they're always hyper locked down and overly restrictive. And you always get exactly what you ask for and nothing more. And the same would be true with the DevBox thing. When you're developing it as, you know, unless you're developing it as part of your solution, it's always going to be subject to not being good enough in some way or the other. It's going to need an update to the config or something, and it's going to have to go through whatever process it goes to make a new one of these things. And it's just not, it'll be a lot like having a VDI, except for even less access.
That's right. Oh, yeah, I was going to get rid of all those jobs anyway.
All right, so I'll find other people to work on my POC.
Oh no, you want me to be part of the POC, right? You want the angry ranter to at least.
Yeah.
Because what if you sway my opinion? You won't, but I mean, you have to listen to me, bitch.
Yeah. I mean, it's a Microsoft product. There's definitely no way I'll convince you, but I can like your dream. Well, Microsoft and NVIDIA, they want to let you know they're also partnering to bring the Grace Blackwell 200 superchips to Azure Cloud. Thanks. Okay, next story. OpenAI Whisper on Azure is now generally available. Whisper is a speech-to-text model from OpenAI that developers can use to transcribe audio files. You can use the Whisper API in both Azure OpenAI Service as well as Azure AI Speech Services on production workloads, knowing that it's backed by Azure's Enterprise Readiness Promise. There's a quote here from Tyler Amundsen, CEO and co-founder of Lightbulb.ai, which is a great name. By merging our call center expertise with tools like Whisper and a combination of LLMs, our product is proved to be 500 times more scalable, 9 times faster, and 20 times more cost-effective than manual call reviews, enabling third-party administrators, brokerages, and insurance companies to not only eliminate compliance risk, but also to significantly improve service and boost revenue. We are grateful for our partnership with Azure, which has been instrumental in our success, and we're enthusiastic about continuing to leverage Whisper to create unprecedented outcomes for their customers.
As there are 6 billion different models for speech-to-text, I have not tried Whisper yet, so...
I mean, this is one from OpenAI, so it's got to be good, right?
It's about to be good.
I mean, like, I don't know what, like, our podcast platform that we record the show on has, you know, added a ton of AI capabilities, including transcripts, and it's scary good. we were using a third party for a little bit to do transcripts. I canceled that. I was like, I don't need that anymore. And, you know, it's just getting added into our core platform. It's great.
Yeah, it's really nice.
I mean, I can almost edit the show just by, actually, I did it earlier because I was doing some tests for a new sponsor, and I had three or four seconds of white space. And I was literally had a transcript that it had generated. And I literally just selected where the blank space was, the 3 seconds, and just clicked it and then hit delete and it cut that out of the audio.
Wow.
It's crazy impressive what it can do. And then, you know, has a bunch of other capabilities as well around using AI to analyze that transcript and then turn it into, you know, show notes and all kinds of other things. Although we prefer the ones that our friends write for us, Heather. So don't be upset, Heather. We're not getting rid of you yet.
Yeah, exactly. There's no AI that can like make me sound intelligible.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
which I enjoy because she'll put it into the into our show notes. Like, and you know, AI is not as good as show note writers or copywriters, which I just leave him. I leave for the enjoyment.
Oh, because that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah. So I've noticed, Heather. I see you. Yeah. Don't get past me. All right, moving to Azure Container Storage, because no one can run a container without storage. Azure Container Storage, now in preview, is a fully managed, cost-efficient volume orchestration service built natively for Kubernetes. Azure Container Storage offers Azure Kubernetes Service integrated block storage volumes for production-scale stateful container applications on Azure. By packing multiple persistent volumes in a single disk, Azure Container Storage helps you achieve better price performance. You can also attach more persistent volumes for Node to reach new scale levels and leverage locally attached ephemeral storage for extremely latency sensitive and IOPS intensive workloads. This was announced in preview at KubeCon Europe, and they're announcing several new capabilities to it right now, including ability to have a temp SSD space, because yes, that's why I want ephemeral storage, is for temp. Achieve reduced TCO with resource optimizations, updates to the AKS CLI, and scaling your backup storage up and on demand to meet your workload storage has all been added as part of the additions to the preview announced at KubeCon Europe. So this is out there available to you to make all of your stateful container dreams come true.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, as much as I'm against you know, stateful data in containers, I'm always sort of curious to see if someone cracks it, because I do think that, you know, it's not going to go away. People are always going to have sort of workloads and use cases that were born of the server world and sort of have that sort of shared model. And so if something can be written that's performant and consistent, it really would be a boon. I mean, other than the fact that you would make me do SQL Server on it. But, you know, I do think that these things they're getting better. They're not all a fuse, you know, storage layer, but and at the file system, it's getting a lot better, a lot more performant. So.
Yeah. Unlike the one we talked about for Google, this one is the good type.
Yeah.
That can do multi-writer. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's all just about performance, right? That's always the trick when you have like 11 billion containers all trying to write against these things. And you have to understand your scaling model very well.
Yeah. It comes to something you have to capacity plan. Yeah, for sure. So there's breaking changes coming to the Azure API management for workspaces. I don't really care about workspaces to talk about that, but I'm more interested in the fact that Azure is cool with breaking API changes with less than 3 months notice. If you use Azure API management for workspaces, no, they're going to screw you up on June 14th. And you can look at more details in our show notes if you care that much. But number one, you published a what's new on breaking changes and you're just messing with people writing automation. It's a bad look, Azure.
Yeah, that's not good at all.
Yeah, like we're completely deprecate the legacy API and you have 3 months to change it. So all that work you've just been doing on our legacy API is now wasted. And you have no time to fix it, which is terrible.
For that one person that's actually using an API to manage workspaces, but you know, it's everyone's just doing ClickOps and that kind of thing. But I still think that's...
I mean, maybe. I mean, Microsoft 365 in general in, you know, Exchange is very PowerShell heavy. So they've been pushing... you know, admins to PowerShell for a long time, but
that's true.
You know, there's probably more APIs than you realize, unfortunately. But if you're using PowerShell modules, they'll just update the module and you'll be okay. But it's still annoying. I don't like it.
Yeah, it is.
Like, give me more time, 3 months. I understand, you know, deprecating an API because it happens. Like, you know, you had an idea, it didn't work out, you had to redesign it, and it doesn't support your service anymore. But you either figure out how to map that in the back end or you give people like a year to get off of the dumb thing.
Yeah, and you make a complaint every time you run it for that year, right?
Like, exactly.
In the code, yeah.
I mean, it's not even breaking changes in that they're just changing the way something works. They're literally removing support for in a workspace is no longer supported in Southern developer tiers. So they're literally removing your ability entirely to use an API to manage these things.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And moving exclusively to a premium tier, of course. As you will.
Oh, I didn't catch that wrinkle. So it's like, oh, this will work fine as long as you pay for it.
Yeah. So if you're using the API to manage developer standard level tiers, that's where it's no longer supported, and then they will be exclusively in the premium tier, but under the Azure API Management V2 tier, not the V1 tier, which is where it originally lived. So it's both. It's deprecating and also making you pay more money for it.
That's
double whammy.
Yeah.
All right. Azure App Service has launched into general availability with the automatic scaling feature. They received great feedback during the preview phase and have several enhancements to go on top of the core capabilities. The new things, if you're familiar already, is the automatic scaling has been expanded to the premium V2 and premium V3 pricing tiers and support for all types, Windows, Linux, and Windows containers. They have a new metric visualization available for web apps where automatic scaling is enabled. And the automatic scaling instance count will report the number of virtual machines on which the app is running, including the pre-warmed instances of it as it's deployed. This is in addition to the core capabilities we announced in the preview, which is the app service platform will automatically scale out the number of running instances of your app to keep up the flow of incoming HTTP requests and automatically scaling your application when you're not getting those requests. Developers can define your per web app scaling and control the minimum number of running instances per apps. And you can also control the maximum number of instances that an underlying app service can scale out to. This ensures that connected resources like databases do not become a bottleneck once automatic scaling is triggered. You can enable or disable automatic scaling for existing app service plans as well as apps within these plans. Address cold start issues for web apps with pre-warmed instances, and automatic scaling is built on a per-second basis using the existing PV2 and PV3 billing parameters, and pre-warmed instances are also charged on a per-second basis using the existing billing meters. So, great if you are using Azure App Services, which I described to Ryan earlier as IIS, but managed.
Wow, all these novel new features, like we'll actually scale this thing for you that we called managed service beforehand. That's it's a revolutionary technology.
All right, let's move on to our next story, which is Oracle. I have Oracle stories. Who doesn't love a good Oracle story?
Oh, yeah.
So I missed this one. It was technically released on March 3rd. I apologize to our Oracle listeners. I don't know who you are. But Oracle has announced the general availability of Oracle Globally Distributed Autonomous Databases. This fully managed OCI service is available in data centers around the world. Built-in cutting-edge capabilities redefine how enterprise manages and processes distributed data to achieve the highest possible levels of scalability and availability and provide data sovereignty features. Think Spanner, but for Oracle and at 12 times the price. Some of the key capabilities of this overly long name service, which I'm now going to call OGDAD from now on, is high availability as it splits logical databases into multiple physical databases or shards that are distributed across multiple data centers, availability domains, or regions. Faults in one shard do not affect others, enhancing overall availability. Automatic replication of the shards across domains or regions provides protection from outages, and OGDAD runs on fault-tolerant Exadata infrastructure for the highest possible availability, which they're not willing to put a SLA on. There's horizontal scalability for you, data sovereignty. There's a choice of data distribution method. You have a globally distributed autonomous database, or you can do lesser things like limited methods, like value-based systems managed or user-defined. You can, of course, get autonomous management. You get AI, of course, because who doesn't get AI these days? Mm-hmm. You get simple application development with a unified logical database view for applications. And all of this sounds really, really expensive. And per Oracle, it is priced based on the number of shards being used and the amount of database consumption on each shard. They say it's simple and predictable, but my calculator, just to start, was $34,000 a month for two shards. It's basically billed by number of shards and the amount of data you want to have in the shards, and then the Exadata hardware underneath it. So if you have for every shard that you want, it needs to be in a different zone. So if you have two shards, that's two Exadata nodes to start with. And then as you start globally replicating these out, you add more and more Exadata nodes. And the Exadata node is actually the most expensive part, as the quarter rack of X9M is $14.51 per hour. And the database server is $2.90 per hour. And the storage server is $2.90. So you're paying for the rack plus the database service plus the storage just to get started, and then you layer on the OGDAD on top of that. So,
I mean, I guess if you're using Oracle database, you're already sort of like independently wealthy. Money means nothing to you, and so what's an extra $34,000 among friends?
Yeah, and that is a license included version. So I don't know what the version with BYOL was, but I'm sure they'll give you a discount if you buy the licenses and then use your own licenses. After you pay them millions of dollars in CapEx. So, maybe look at Spanner if you need this one. Mm-hmm. I think the lock-in is worth it on this case. Because when I start, I was just fooling around with it. But 10 shards. 10 shards seems reasonable, for something distributed globally. I was thinking four regions, probably some data sovereignty, whatever. And then all of a sudden the price is $1.1 million. I'm like, what the hell happened?
Yeah.
okay.
Wait till you get the bill for using a calculator.
Yeah, exactly. Ooh. Need a whole Exadata cluster just to run the calculator.
Yeah.
And apparently, because they want to fleece Kenya, they are meeting to grow demand across Africa. OCI is planning on opening a public cloud region in Nairobi, Kenya. Oracle will be taking advantage of Kenya's renewable energy and digital infrastructure, including abundant submarine and national connectivity. Submarine is that's what they call
it. Oh, so they've moved beyond just semi trucks.
Yes.
For their regions. Now there's submarines too.
Exactly. Sweet.
What's the bandwidth of a submarine?
I don't. Is it Wi-Fi enabled submarine or satellite enabled? Because the latency might be a killer. Yeah.
Lasers.
So, anyways,
uses lasers.
Oracle's definitely not going to be selling, I imagine, a lot of these Oracle OG dads to the Kenyan people, because I don't know that there's that much money in Kenya to pay for that. But they're going to be there. Cabinet Secretary of Kenya was very excited about it. Oracle's intent to open a public cloud region in Nairobi will be a key component of Kenya's bottom-up economic transformation agenda initiative, which is focused on digital transformation, private sector development, agricultural transformation, housing development, and healthcare modernization. And I'm just still stuck on Oracle taking advantage of Kenya. But cheap building land, cheap labor, expensive cooling perhaps, but great. Thanks.
They must love it though, because Oracle's so expensive, and they're going to get some kind of sales tax revenue. on top of that. So, please bring me your expensive stuff. I'll happily tax it at 25%.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that is it, guys. Another great show once again, and we will see you next week here at the Cloud Pod.
Yep. I'll see you later. Thanks.
Bye, everybody.
And that is The Week in Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet us with the hashtag #poundthecloudpod.